Okay, folks, welcome to the first chapter, the first report, the first exciting episode of 2023 on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the rock chip writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, first thing I have to say to you is Happy New Year, but I do have this strict rule that if anybody says Happy New Year to me after midday on New Year's Day, I usually feel like punching them in the face. As far as I'm concerned, oh yes, absolutely. As far as I'm concerned, when the midnight bell has struck and went into the new year, then just get on with it. Don't go around telling everybody you want them to have a Happy New Year. When I worked on the Chester Chronicle, that was my first job in newspapers as a young reporter on the weekly newspaper in my hometown. The editor was a guy called Bob somebody. I can't remember his surname, but he was a former Spitfire pilot from the Second World War. So he was literally a war hero, you know. And he came round on the 21st of January and started wishing us all a Happy New Year. And that was the first indication that he was starting to suffer from dementia.
Oh, that's sad. That's very sad. But I've always had a thing that the first time I communicate with somebody in the new year, even if it's halfway through January, I'll say Happy New Year to them.
Really? Yeah.
So I'm completely the opposite from you.
Yeah.
Or you get an email from somebody, you know, it might be nearly February, but it's the first time you've spoken.
Yeah.
I'll still say it back.
Yeah.
But yeah, horses for courses.
No, absolutely. I just think, right, a new year's a new opportunity. Let's get on with things. Let's do all the things that, you know, you're going to do last year. But now I haven't got time to go around wishing people Happy New Year. Let's just get on with it. Talking of which, I've already revealed to yourself and a few other people, actually, on a couple of shows I've done in the last couple of days. But my New Year's ambition for New Year, resolution I'm talking about, of course, is...
I knew there was a word.
Is that I'm going to definitely learn how to play the guitar. I'm taking guitar lessons. I'm in the process of buying a guitar and I'm going to write a hit song between now and my birthday, which, of course, is on December the 29th. So... watch this space as it develops.
Magnificently enterprising of you.
Yeah.
I've got to ask, who's teaching you?
Well, that'll be a guitar teacher, if you see what I mean. It's local. There's a music school round where I live in Stockbroker Belt, and I'm going up there to sign up for a series of lessons, probably two a week. And I want to know how, you know, things like basic chords work and all that kind of stuff, you know. But I've always kind of known inside my head that I'm a genius at something, but I haven't yet discovered what it is. You know, I thought that maybe I could have been a genius Formula One motor racing driver, but I missed the opportunity to jump into a car when I was sort of 15 or 16, you know. I could have been a genius at maybe, I don't know, something I've never tried, like archery or something like that. But I think music I will take too easily. I'm not worried about the words because songwriters obviously have to write music and words. And I've always been really good with the words, not as good as you are, of course, Miss Jones. But, you know, words have been our currency for decades now. So I have no fear of that. But I've got to put them together. So that's what I'm going to do.
So do you read music to begin with?
No. But then again, neither did John Lennon, nor does Paul McCartney. So that's not a hindrance at all.
Well, that's true. But I was going to say, I know an awful lot of guitarists, working guitarists, session guitarists of great magnitude. And if you ever want a masterclass with one of them, I'm sure I can fix it up.
I'm sure you could as well. I might even, you know, get really bold and, you know, approach one of your friends, somebody like Mike Batt or somebody like that, you know what I mean? Who, of course, has written some of the most famous songs that we've ever listened to. It'd be a bit cheeky and all that. But it's funny what you sent me a note last night saying, oh, you know, I'm sure people are interested. I might be able to make it a campaign and, you know, get people interested in following my progress or something like that. And anyway, I've got a wide range of thoughts. First thing I've got to do is learn to play the basic sort of, you know, strings on a guitar and then take it from there.
Well, I wish you luck. I think it's noble enterprise. It's worthy, a worthy way to spend your time. It is said that later in life, as we all are, sort of in the last third of our lives, I suppose, at this stage in the game, that expanding the brain by learning something like how to play a musical instrument or a language, how to speak a new language that you haven't attempted before, is one of the things that keeps us healthy into older age because it expands the brain.
No, I'm sure.
Otherwise, the brain is contracting all the time.
I'm sure.
So I really wish you luck, and I look forward to hearing about your progress.
Yes, thank you. Speaking Spanish is also another ambition of mine, you know, to go to Spain one of these days and try and converse, but I was just too idle to do that. You could do that.
Well, I can help you with that because I did my degree in French and Spanish.
Fantastic.
And a little bit rusty, but I usually find once I'm in Spain or France for a day or two, it comes back very quickly. I find myself conversing very easily, and I try to keep up reading books in those languages as well.
Excellent. A multilinguist, Miss Jones. I would expect nothing less of you. Now, Sir Brian May. I mean, that came as a bolt out of the blue to me because, you know, nearly every prominent musician in this country has been knighted. You know, Rod Stewart, Sir Paul McCartney, Sir Mick Jagger, Sir Elton John. But I never really put Brian May into that bracket. But I suppose you'll be, you know, you with your past associations with Queen and Freddie Mercury, who undoubtedly would have been knighted, I think, if he was still alive. You must be very pleased for Sir Brian May.
Yes, I'm pleased for him. The point has been made that had Freddie Mercury lived, had he survived, that Brian wouldn't have got a look in because Brian was, after all, only his guitarist.
Well,
Freddie was the front man of the band and the focal point of the band. Yeah. I'm not sure during the Queen's lifetime whether Freddie would have been considered for a knighthood because of his alternative lifestyle.
Well,
if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but it didn't stop Sir Elton John being knighted, did it? And, you know, I thought,
I suppose not. Yeah, although Elton was doing a lot of charity work, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And I'm sure Freddie Mercury would have done, you know, had he lived in possibly the same direction, you know what I mean? All those charities that Elton John supports. But nevertheless, it's great recognition. And I know we've spoken about this before, but I mean, we can't escape the fact that in this country, we have got all the world's greatest musicians. America have got a couple, but we've really got them all in this country, haven't we?
Yeah, it is a funny thing that rock and roll grew out of the blues, out of the black American music of the Deep South and so on. Yeah. And our returning that music to them in our own incarnation, if you like, was a bit Coles to Newcastle, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
So we took that ball and ran with it. Yeah. And it is incredible. I think it's, you know, lots of people have tried to unravel the secret as to why this should have happened.
Yeah.
And it's something to do with being a small collection of islands, which has been invaded many times. So we've had many, many cultures coming to these shores. And we've been a real melting pot of artistic endeavour. And I think that that has to have something to do with it.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely sure you're right there. And I just, you know, I just stand back in awe sometimes and look at the musical talent we've got here and wonder, like you just said, a small collection of islands. How did we produce all these people? I suppose because we speak English, it helps, doesn't it? Because, you know, Sweden produced ABBA, but if ABBA hadn't sung in English, they wouldn't have even been known in Scandinavia, let alone England. Did you know, by the way, I only found out last year that when ABBA won the Eurovision Song Contest in Brighton in 1970, whatever it was, 73, 74, something like that, I think. They got null points from the British judges. Did you know that?
I think we were quite resentful of them because didn't we have Olivia Newton-John that year representing us?
Did we,
In a beautiful blue frock. And the whole of this country was in love with Olivia.
Right.
And we were so rooting for her. We thought we had it in the bag and so on. And I think we must have seen Sweden, ABBA, as our biggest threat.
Right.
And therefore we were trying to, you know, we were playing tactically.
Right.
The way we criticise everybody else for doing when they vote in the competition today.
Yeah. But imagine voting no points for ABBA considering what they've become since. It's just remarkable. But the point is,
it is. And also they're one of the most popular bands in this country, aren't they?
They are, and the world. But I only found reading something over the last couple of days that one of the TV executives pointed out that the reason that ABBA got null points was because a lot of the judges based their voting on having watched the last rehearsal before the main night competition. And in the last rehearsal, ABBA sung the song in Swedish.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, yes, because English is the universal cultural language, isn't
right.
it, after all? And it's just some aberration that it's the language spoken in America, being the sort of cultural centre of the world,
It has been. Because America could easily have been Spanish, couldn't it, you know, with the conquest that kind of stuff. But it could have even been French because, you know, the War of Independence was fought between us, the Americans, and the French. So, but that's all so interesting. Talking about ABBA, by the way, did you know that I went to the ABBA Experience?
Yes, you said that I think your sister gave it to you for a Christmas
present. It was my niece, actually, and I went with my niece and her boyfriend, and, you know, it was great and all that.
Now, what did you think of it?
I thought it was brilliant, honestly. I mean, it was more like going to one of those circular cinemas. Is it called Cinemax or something? What are they called?
Oh, the IMAX.
The IMAX, that's right, yeah, because it was all around you. It was on the ceiling and it was on the walls and everything, but focused on a stage where it looked like there were human beings. It was a remarkable production. We've talked about this because we said, the Beatles are going to be done like that and all that. But the point I was going to make was that I was working in television yesterday and the crew at the TV station were going off to see ABBA, you know, very excited about that. And I thought, what an impact that's had. And then I got a train home from London and I saw a huge advert for Mamma Mia on the Underground. And I thought, my God, what an impact ABBA have made on the world in the last 30 or 40 years. I think Mamma Mia is the most successful stage show in the world now.
Well, it's still going, isn't it? And has had productions all over the world. Mm. And people were very critical in the past of what they call jukebox musicals.
Yeah.
So stage productions that are built as a vehicle for the songs themselves.
Yeah.
But people got past that very quickly and they go along because they love ABBA music.
Yeah,
the storyline of Mamma Mia isn't all that.
No.
It's a very simple story, but it works in terms of supporting the songs, which is what it was designed to do.
That's right. Is it the same as the TV version? I saw the TV version with Pierce Brosnan, and it was about three blokes all going to an island to see their former wife because they were all fathers of her three children or something, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't made for television. It was made as a feature film, cinema feature film, and it's just been repeated on television in later years. But, there's a second, a sort of sequel to it.
Yeah.
The original film, feature film, starred Meryl Streep.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it did. Yeah.
For some reason, they killed her off for the sequel. And to me, it was detrimental. I could never get over the fact.
I thought she turned it down. I thought she didn't want to do the sequel or something.
We never knew the full story as to whether she was committed to another film project.
Wasn't Julie Walters in it or Julie Walters? Or
yes, Julie Walters is in both feature films.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Pierce Brosnan, I can't remember who else. But I mean, yes, it's a simple story, but it works. It really, it's kitsch and it's corny, but it works.
That's right.
And that thing, especially in musical films, of people suddenly breaking out of nowhere into a song and dance routine, it's a bit silly when you deconstruct it. But in something like that, it really does work. It's a very popular film.
Oh, it is very, it's like Sound of Music, really, isn't it? I remember the first time I saw that. My mum took us. We were only like 6, 7 and 8 at the time, you know, myself and my two sisters, and it was magical. You know, Julie Andrews running up a mountain and bursting into song. Fantastic, wasn't it? But anyway, there you go. Now, Miss Jones, I know you're a spiritual woman and you'll have been to a couple of services over Christmas and all that. So how do you feel about the passing of one Pope who will, I think it's today or tomorrow, will be sort of passed on into heaven by another Pope? It's a bit unusual, that, isn't it?
Well, it is, because Pope Benedict, who died, resigned.
Yeah.
I think he was the first pope in
600 years.
Many hundreds of years, yeah, who resigned the post because there was a lot of controversy at the time. Mm. I think there was, that we know, there was abuse in the Catholic Church that he did not expose, that kind of thing. He was held responsible. It's an interesting concept of pope. Mm. I've never quite been able to understand Catholicism, although I respect it, mm-hmm, for a few reasons. One is papal infallibility, which they subscribe to. So in other words, anything that the Pope decrees is fact, and it's indisputable, and it is infallible because he says it,
right,
which sort of sets the Pope on the same shelf as God. And I have a problem with that, because the Pope is only a human being, after all.
Yeah.
He does not transcend death. We know that because a pope has just died,
right,
and is about to be buried.
Yeah.
They also have this concept of transubstantiation, in which they believe that when you consume the bread and the wine, the body and blood of Christ, that those elements literally turn into the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ within your own body once you've consumed
them. Right.
And I can't go for that either. Mm. The Anglican Church has a different take on those things, as we know.
Yeah.
And I suppose there are dictatorial aspects of Catholicism which I could not subscribe to. It was a conversation we had after I got married, because I married a Catholic.
Right.
And we were trying to decide how to raise our children, whether they would be Anglicans, Anglican Christians, or Catholic Christians. Mm-hmm. And in the end, because I would have had to convert to Catholicism.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was decided that because I would be the one taking the kids to church, and I couldn't compromise my own beliefs and change them to those of my husband for the sake of taking one's children to church. It just seemed, it was a step too far for me.
Right.
So I didn't convert because I had my own beliefs and I would be the one taking the kids to church. So, but none of which is to say that I criticize Catholicism. I have absolute respect for everybody who believes whatever they want, because that is what faith is all about.
Yeah. Well,
but I do have issues with Catholicism. Yeah.
Well, in that case, you have Henry VIII to thank for it, don't you? Because if he hadn't decided that the Pope was irrelevant because he wanted to get his leg over with a chambermaid who turned out to be his next wife, then we'd still all be Catholic, wouldn't we?
Well, there's some argument against that as well. I think it was Elizabeth, his daughter, who really kick-started the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are lots of takes on history. And as we know, history is written by those who survive and thrive. So we never quite know the full story.
That's right. History written by the victors. But that's very interesting, because only this morning I've read this amazing story about a nun and a monk, right, who happened to bump into each other in pursuit of their work. The nun had been in a nunnery for 25 years. The monk had been a friar for 12 years. And the uniforms they wore, he wore a habit and she wore whatever a nun wears. Is that a habit as well?
I think they got out of the habit, didn't
they? They did, yeah. And
boom, boom!
You know, that's Miss Jones is a family show after all.
Sorry.
And all of a sudden, he sends her a note saying, would you give up your religion if I asked you to marry me? And after 25 years, she said yes. So they both gave it up and they literally got married, and they're living as an ordinary couple. And although they're both Catholic, he's now got a job as a vicar in a Church of England church. What a remarkable story.
Well, that is, I read it and I thought, yes, that is, it's an incredible love story. You could make a film out of that, couldn't you?
But yeah.
I wonder whether, because the Anglican Church is not a dilution of Catholicism. Mm. It's very important to stress that.
Yeah.
He would have had to study and he would have had to be ordained as an Anglican priest. Mm. Instead of, he wasn't a Catholic priest in the first place. So it would have taken a length of time, is what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
This couldn't have happened overnight.
Yeah.
He would have had to study and be ordained in the Anglican Church for that to happen. So I'd be interested to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's completely amazing story. Somebody's going to go along and get the lowdown on the whole inside thing, aren't they? You know, you'll read over three pages in a Sunday newspaper or something like that.
Oh, it's a great film. Yeah, somebody needs to make that. Snap up the rights, guys.
Yeah, I totally agree. Did I ever tell you about an old mate of mine, Norman Luck? Norman Luck was a reporter on the Daily Express, a very, very good reporter. He's the guy who I sent to Australia, and he uncovered the fact that old Foggy, that was Princess Anne's first husband, Captain Mark Phillips, had an illegitimate child in Australia. We heard rumours about it, and, you know, then we heard another rumour. We put a bit together. I sent Norm to Australia and said, you've got to stand this up, Norm. He was there 3 weeks, but in the end he did. He found a birth certificate and he put it all together, confronted Mark Phillips, who eventually held his hands up and said, yes, it's true. But the reason I'm telling you about this is another great story Norm brought in one day was, he said, you won't believe this. I said, what? He said, I came across a lady of the night last night. He didn't exactly tell us why he had come across this lady of the night, right? And he said, and I was with her at her place, and there was a picture on the wall of a nun. And I said, why do you have a picture of a nun on the wall? She said, because that's me. And he said, what do you mean? She said, yes, I used to be a nun, but I gave it up to become an escort. And she did. And it was a brilliant story, another four-page pull-out story. Norm was quite sharp and quite shrewd. And we were working.
And did he make his excuses and leave?
Well, we never quite got into that.
Yeah, I bet not. Yeah. It's very interesting to know, if we could possibly know, yeah, what he was doing in the house of the escort in the first place.
Well, research, I think you'll find.
Yeah, that's what they call it.
Norman,
yeah,
would have answered that one. But no, Norman was a good guy. He's happily married, respectable. His wife is a lovely lady. And I'm sure it was all the interests of work and nothing else. But in the days when information was even more sacrosanct than it is now, because there was no social media and all that, we came out on whatever day it was, Wednesday. The Sun went mad because it was a very, very sunnish story, wasn't it? And one of the Sun reporters turned up at the Daily Express to find Norm and paid Norm £1,000 for the nun's phone number.
You know? Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, that would have been in breach of his arrangement with the Daily Express. Surely he should have been fired for that.
Well, we didn't know about it until 10 years later. So, you know, it was...
Interesting. If you're a staff reporter on one newspaper, you can't be selling info to another.
Well, except that we'd already published the story, if you see what I mean. And so it was all over the place and all that. And all we were doing, really, was saving the guy a few hours of going to having to find it himself. Sun had so much money in those days. I mean, you know, they were selling 4.5 million a day. And for instance, they would buy every book that was going to be published in September, not because they were going to publish the, excerpts.
Serialization.
Thank you very much. You should know that, Miss Jones. Not that they're going to publish the serialization of every book, but they were going to pick the best one, publish it, but then just dump all the others so that the opposition couldn't get them. But that's the way Fleet Street worked in the days when we were literally rolling around in money, whereas now budgets on newspapers are incredibly tight, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, God. You talk about The Sun. I remember when I published my book on Naomi Campbell.
Right.
Would have been, I think, late 80s, something like that. And The Sun paid £50,000 for the serialisation.
There you go, yeah.
You are lucky these days to get a grand for serialization rights.
Right.
And if you're looking at the Times or something like that, you're lucky to get 450 quid.
Good God, I didn't realise
that. I got 50 grand from The Sun, and I got £10,000 from the Daily Mail for second serial.
That's fantastic,
Those were the days. Yeah. But as you say, the circulations were gigantic compared to what they are now. Yeah. Advertising revenue was at an all-time high.
Was.
So they could afford. But the thing is about dumping all those books that they bought the rights to does authors absolutely no favours whatsoever, because what they're seeking when they do serialisation deals is publicity.
And yes, you're absolutely right, stirring up interest in the book itself,
Yeah. So if they've thrown all those in the gutter, you know, that those publishers ought to be crying into their cups of tea because they've completely missed the point of publishing the book.
I totally agree. But when they're bought, they assume, this will be over three pages now in The Sun. And if it doesn't appear, they've got no control over it after they've sold the
right. No, they haven't.
So there we are. Talking about Daily Express, by the way, Mrs. Jones, should mention, we don't look backwards in this podcast, we look forwards, but another great story about your father, which related, of course, to the world's, you know, greatest ever footballer dying, Pele, and a picture of your legendary journalist father, Ken Jones, with Pele. Where was that again?
That was in Mexico in 1974, and it was just after Pele had announced he wasn't going to play for Brazil in the World Cup that
that's
year.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
But my father had met Pele in Mexico in 1970.
Yes.
And they bonded. They had the same background, pretty much. Mm-hmm. They were both the sons of footballers. Yeah. They'd both come from nothing. Yeah. They'd both risen through the ranks, and they had football in their blood. You know, they were sort of blessed and cursed by the beautiful game, as Pele himself dubbed it.
Yes.
And even though there was a language barrier, there was a geographical barrier, they became friends. Yeah. And that photo, which has been in a frame on the wall in my father's office at the house for donkey's years.
Yeah.
It's such a great picture because it shows that they were true friends.
Yes, it does.
And when I heard about, must be a month ago now, that Pele was not long for this world, I was talking to one of the features editors at The Express, and I said, oh, by the way, I've heard this, that, you know, Pele's not long for this world. And he said, oh, well, the daughter is saying that he's making a full recovery and all the rest. I said, watch this space. I said, I'd really like to write a reflection on my father's friendship with him. And he said, do it. Do it for us, and we'll hold it.
Yeah, right.
And let us know if you hear anything, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And it was destined as a spread on the features pages, actually. But then News got hold of it, and they seized it, and they ran it on page 8, which is, of course, is a better showcase page, isn't it? Page 8
absolutely.
In the newspaper.
Absolutely.
They were really pleased with it. So I was glad to have done it. And then I ran the feature-length version of that piece on my blog, which is on my website, if anybody would like to read
it. I advise everybody who has the slightest interest in journalism or football to get onto that blog immediately. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, Ratchet Writer Extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Leslie Ann, I've already said once, we don't look backwards on this podcast, we look forwards. But, unfortunately, I am embarking today upon the miserable task of trying to put my penthouse apartment back together again after the devastation wreaked, the havoc that ensued upon Christmas Eve, when I suffered a burst pipe. What a miserable start to Christmas that was.
I'm so sorry to hear that, because what a mess, what a nightmare. What did you have a huge amount of damage?
Well, yes, because, you know, strangest things happen. So it's in the run-up to Christmas, and it's the 23rd, and I'm literally packing up stuff because I'm going off to Bournemouth to my sister's on Christmas Eve, and stay about 3 or 4 days, something like that, you know. And I'd already been down and put stuff in the car and the presents and all that kind of stuff. And then knock on the door. And I don't usually get knocks on my door because I've got a buzzer entrance system downstairs. You see what I mean? So my buzzer would go and it'd be somebody outside. So I went to the door and there's a young chap there. And he said, oh, hello. He said, I'm sorry to bother you. He said, I live downstairs. I said, I'm sorry? He said, yeah, I live in the apartment below you. Because you never see people there. You know what I mean? People come and go, but you don't see them. And I said, oh, he said, look, and he's a terribly polite young man. And he said, I've got water dripping through my ceiling and I'm wondering whether it's coming from your apartment because I'm right below you. And I said, well, I said, I'm not aware of any leak. I said, but I tell you what I'll do. I will inspect all my, you know, fittings and all that kind of stuff. And what number are you in? He told me. I said, I'll come down and see you. Anyway, I went round my place on hands and knees, you know, round all the radiators, into the kitchen to see if the washing machine had possibly had a, you know, a fractured pipe in it or something like that. I went into both bathrooms. I've got a shower room and I've got a bathroom. And I, you know, I tried to get under the bath and into the shower tray. Nothing at all. Couldn't find anything at all. So I went downstairs and I said, look, I said, you know, I can't find anything. I said, I've got a roof garden as well, right? And but the roof garden is immaculately lead lined all the way round, and we've never had a problem with that. But I went out and had a look at that. He said, oh, well, thanks very much anyway. I'll get on to the managing agents. So the thought then was it might have been coming through the roof, but diverting, you know, down past my apartment down the wall cavities or something like that. Anyway, you know, managing agent said, it's got to come from your apartment. I said, they sent a so-called expert round. And this guy did exactly what I'd done. He inspected everything and said, no, it's not coming from here. It must be coming from the ceiling of the chap downstairs. He must have pipes in the ceiling. So the next morning, they came back because he wasn't there. And they said, we've got to take your ceiling down. There's pipes in it which have burst. And to start off with, they thought, oh, it's a suspended ceiling. Then they realised it wasn't. There was no gap in the ceiling at all. The underneath of my floor was his ceiling. They said, it's got to be coming from yours. So then they came back up here and got one of those machines that detect damp, right? And the damp was right in the middle of my lounge. I mean, bang in the middle of my... I said, but it doesn't feel wet at all. They said, no, water goes down, not up. I think it's a heating pipe in a duct that goes from one radiator to another. It's got a fracture. And I said, how are we going to find out? He said, everything's got to come up. So all the furniture had to be moved out. The carpet was torn up. The floorboards were torn up because it's concrete, but it's got wooden flooring in it, if you see what I mean. And there it was. We found the rogue pipe, which was leaking at the rate of a dripping tap. But when that goes on for a week, it all builds up. You know what I mean? We're very lucky. It was Christmas Eve. We managed to get a plumber, you know, one of these 24-hour day plumbers, came. I think within 15 minutes, he'd fixed it. He cut out a section of the pipe. He had to drain the boiler or the tank or whatever it is into the bath. And then he replaced the section of pipe and welded it together and then refilled the boiler and he'd gone. It took him about half an hour, honestly. It was amazing. But the devastation has been like this ever since. I haven't been able to get anybody between Christmas and New Year. And the worst problem, I'm sorry, I'm doing a lot of moaning here to our millions of listeners, is the dust. If you've got concrete floors and you pull up fitted carpet with the underlay and all that, the dust is awful. Honestly, it's everywhere.
I'm so sorry. So who pays for all of this?
Well, that's the next question, because obviously there's insurance companies involved. Insurance companies say that you're not covered for, you know, a pipe in the floor and all this kind of stuff. And
so why are you not covered? That's the next question.
I don't know, but I mean, that's the initial response that's coming back. You're not covered for it. The pipe didn't break because it was frozen. It wasn't a frozen pipe. It was a bracket fitted onto the pipe when this place was built 24 years ago, had just corroded through the copper of the water pipe, you know.
Well, I would contest that. I can't see that you wouldn't be covered for that, because it's not something you've done.
I totally agree with you. And you know, I shall be pursuing that. That's not a problem. It's a problem you really don't need, isn't it? But I'm also liable for the damage to the apartment below me and the one below that, because it went through the apartment downstairs into the one below that. So it's a bit of a mess, so it's got to be sorted out. But there we go. These are...
I'm very sorry.
It's not your fault, Leslie. That's nobody else's fault. But it's been horrible, like, walking around my place because the dust everywhere, the carpets are up, the planking is up and all that. Luckily, people are coming today and it will all be sorted sooner rather than later. Now, Ms. Jones, let me throw this one at you. It's the birthday today of a bloke called John Paul Jones. He's 77, and he is the little-known fourth member of Led Zeppelin, isn't he?
Oh, he's such a lovely man, John Paul Jones. Yes, I do. He's just gorgeous. He's not somebody you would think of as some great sort of sinister musician in a band like Led Zeppelin. Yeah. He's the sweetest heart of all. He really is. But it's interesting. Oh, yeah. It's interesting that the musicians who were put together to form Led Zeppelin in the first place had all been session musicians of some renown. Yeah. Before they got together as that band.
Yes.
And he's just so musical. He's such a sweetheart. Mm. He's so genuinely lovely and humble and laid back. You know, he's not somebody who pushes himself forward, which is why most people have never heard of him.
Was he the bass guitarist then?
Yes, yeah. Right. But he also plays a mean mandolin. I saw him at a concert. It was an 80th birthday gig for Julie Felix.
Yeah.
And he got up and played the mandolin at that. She had a lot of musicians there, sort of, that she'd worked with over the years. Yeah. And yeah, he was one of them.
Because I say he's the least known member of Led Zeppelin, because the rest are all notorious. John Bonham, the drummer, what was his name? Bozo or Bonzo or something. And,
yeah.
And he died after picking up the phone in a hotel in America and at 6 a.m. in the morning and ordering 2 ham and cheese sandwiches and 3 large vodka and tonics. And by the time the, I don't know why I'm laughing. It's not funny when somebody dies, is it? By the time the...
apparently it is.
Apparently it is, yeah. By the time the room service guy got to the room, John Bonham died because he was quite partial to like chemical substances, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, look, Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, we know all the stories, don't we?
The others are notorious. Jimmy Page is notorious for his battles with the guy who lives next door to him, his house in Hampstead. Who am I talking about? Robbie Williams.
Robbie Williams, yeah.
And of course, he had a great love of young ladies, didn't he, Jimmy Page? And
extremely young ladies,
well, yes. Well, as you say, yeah. And then, of course, Robert Plant, I mean, famous for his curly locks, yeah?
Percy Plant. I think he's famous for a lot more than his curly locks, well, shall we say. You know. Unless curly locks is a euphemism.
Oh, dear.
But it is a family show.
Yeah, it is a family show. But anyway, I just found that interesting. Also, the story about why they were called Led Zeppelin, L-E-D, Zeppelin, was because Keith Moon said to, it might have been Jimmy Page, it was one of them, he said, I'm giving up, doing whatever he was doing, session musician, you told me. We're going to form a new band. And he told me, and Keith Moon apparently said, you'll go down like a lead balloon in America. There's not a market for it. And so that's why they call themselves Led Zeppelin. But they spelt it L-E-D because they said the Americans will pronounce it as lead and it's got to be Led Zeppelin. So that's how that came about.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. But a lot of their notoriety was down to the antics of their manager, Peter Grant.
That's right.
He was a most notorious character.
Mm. Like you wouldn't a gangster, want to meet, wasn't he?
Yeah, you wouldn't want to meet him up a dark alley on a black night, you know, one of those. But I think some of the mythology is way, way exaggerated, but a lot of it, unfortunately, was true.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. Peter Grant, by the way, we kind of got to know him a bit when we were working in America. You know, he was very notorious then. I remember he at some concerts, he would demand to be paid in cash. I mean, literally $100,000 bills in cash in a box in the dressing room before they go on stage. And on one occasion, he told us that the 100 grand got nicked from the aeroplane used to fly around in that Mickey Brennan used to take all the pictures on, you know, the
whatever. Yeah.
Somebody at the airport nicked the box with all the money in it. So, you know.
The stories. Yeah. I had a very nice message from Mickey Brennan the other day, actually. Just reflecting on my dad after I wrote that piece about Pele.
Oh, lovely. Good, that's great.
Yeah, so he's alive and well and kicking in Costa Rica.
He is, just for the benefit of our millions of listeners. Mickey Brennan's the legendary news photographer based in the United States of America since he was about 25 or 26. When I was there in the 80s and the 90s, he was the kind of staff photographer for the Daily Mirror, so he will have worked very closely with your father, Leslie, at all the big boxing matches, won't he, at all the big fights, you know.
He did, yeah. He referred to my dad as Kenny, and they were quite a team, I think.
Oh, they were.
Formidable back in the day.
Yeah. Mickey was brilliant at taking pictures ringside, you know, poking his long lens through the bottom rope, under the bottom rope, and getting those fantastic shots. And as you quite rightly say, he married a Costa Rican girl, retired to Costa Rica, where he lives now. He sometimes visits England. A mate of mine down in Kent sometimes sees him. So if he's back again and he contacts you, let me know and I'll come and have a drink with you both.
Definitely.
Yeah. Talking music, of course, we can't have a life on Planet Porky without a Beatles reference. And you must have seen the piece I saw the other day. I think it was in the Mail on Sunday or something. It was our old friend, what's his name? You know,
Ray Connolly.
Ray Connolly, thank you, yeah. And it was weirdly presented as Ray Connolly comparing Yoko Ono to Meghan Markle, except that Meghan Markle got like a one-line mention, you know, about being an American who kidnapped a great Englishman and took him to America. And Ray compared this to Yoko Ono, an American woman who kidnapped a great Englishman and took him to America, and we never saw him again. But it was a fascinating story about the devotion that John Lennon eventually had for Yoko Ono, and this quote left off the page and hit me in the face. Lennon always told me, this is Ray Connolly's words, Lennon always told me Yoko was an extraordinary woman. He used to say, quotes, why should I work with Paul McCartney when I can work with Yoko Ono? I mean, have you ever heard anything like that?
Well, I thought it was ridiculous. I'm a great fan of Ray Connolly's. Yeah. I thought this was a spurious feature idea because you cannot compare Prince Harry and Meghan Markle and John Lennon and Yoko Ono in the first place. There's absolutely nothing to compare. The reason that the Lennons went to New York was not that Yoko was stealing him away from the British, but they were looking for her missing daughter, and who was last sighted in America. And they went there with no intention of staying there forever, but they just went looking for her child. And this was completely overlooked. Had it been John Lennon's own child, the world would have gone mad about it. But because it was Yoko's and everybody hated Yoko, it was ignored. And I was pretty angry about that when I was researching my book on John. Secondly, the Beatles had come to a natural end. They couldn't stand the sight of each other anymore. And there was this great sort of nostalgia for, oh, the Beatles, it's the end of the world. You know, we can't possibly survive without this band. The world can't go on. We can't let anybody infiltrate this and cause their breakup. So along come Linda, who married Paul, and Yoko, who married John, and they became to blame for the Beatles' breakup. It's not true. And I wish, with the greatest respect, that people like Ray Connolly wouldn't keep banging on about it, because it's a false narrative. They broke up because they'd come to a natural end. They'd been writing songs together for a very long time, since they were little boys. And they grew up. You know, get over it. They grew up and they went their separate ways. That's all that happened. And John and Yoko did create some very, very good songs together.
Yeah. Well, Yoko was a bit of an artist. I mean, she did inspire Imagine, didn't she, with that sort of book she wrote or whatever. But
she did and co-wrote the song. And also she was a musician, a concert pianist, long before she met John Lennon. So it was never as though she was trying to muscle in on John's career. I hate the fact that this mythology persists.
Well, Ray says,
and nobody has any power to do anything about
Ray
it.
Ray says in that piece that she hit on Paul McCartney first, but he wasn't interested. Then Ringo, who couldn't understand, you know, her philosophy and all that, and ended up with John. So anyway, look.
It's not true. Well, with the greatest respect to Ray, she went to Paul McCartney to ask him to invest in, to support one of her artistic installations. And he turned her down. Paul was the great art collector of all four Beatles. You know, he'd already bought a Matisse at that point. This was in the 60s. And he had a collection of art second to none, which is why Yoko approached him to support one of her installations. And he said no. And she did end up going to John to ask him to support her financially in one of her creative endeavours. And it just so happened that they fell in love. You know, it happens, folks. Get over
it. The other amazing thing I learned over Christmas was that the drummer on the Ballad of John and Yoko, you know, the way things are going, they're going to crucify me. The drummer on that song was Paul McCartney.
Yeah, Paul's a very competent drummer, actually.
Yeah, it was amazing. Apparently, they were at Abbey Road, and it was over Christmas, I think, and Ringo was abroad and George Harrison wasn't around, and John said he wanted to record it now because he had to go away with Yoko or something like that. And he said to Paul, will you play the drums? And Paul apparently did. I mean, that's just astonishing.
Well, not really. We should remember that Paul McCartney has created entire albums on which he's played all the instruments.
Sure, but what I'm saying is, within the Beatles, for Paul McCartney to be the drummer on another number one single is just astonishing. You couldn't imagine Ringo being lead guitarist, could you, you know?
Well, take an album like Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones. In several of the tracks on that double album do not have Bill Wyman as the bass player because he happened not to be in the studio that day. It's more common than you think. And also, in recordings by bands, you will have session musicians actually on the recordings and not the official band members themselves. I've got a friend, Clem Cattini, wonderful, wonderful friend of mine. He's in his 80s. He was a member of the Tornadoes in the way back when, but he has been a session drummer on more than 40 number one hits. Yeah. All of those bands had their own drummers, wow. but Clem was the guy in the studio wow. performing on the drums that day.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing, isn't it? The talent these people have. Right, Miss Jones, I'm going to end today on paying tribute to a woman I've been in love with for 50 years, and that is Victoria Principal, who played Pammy in Dallas. She was Bobby's wife. Do you remember her?
Of course I do, yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, the first time I saw her and that bob of hair that she had and a gorgeous figure and beautiful face, I thought, that is the woman of my dreams, right? And I still think she's probably the woman on TV I've most fancied during the whole of my life.
That's sweet. Well, she doesn't look like that anymore. She's had a lot of plastic surgery. In fact, she married a plastic surgeon.
She did, right, yeah.
And she and Linda Gray from Dynasty,
Linda Gray was in Dallas as well. She was, wasn't she? She was.
No,
she was,
I don't mean Linda Gray. I mean Linda, the other one who was in Dynasty, the very white blonde.
Yes, I know who you mean. Yeah.
Linda somebody. Yes. She was also a Linda, but I can't remember the surname.
Yes, she was,
case.
Yeah.
But they had so much plastic surgery that they ended up looking like freaks.
Really?
And they are a walking lesson in why not to commit oneself to cosmetic updates, if you like.
Oh, well, listen, don't ever show me a picture of Victoria Principal that's
as she is now. No. I'm going to look for one as soon as we stop recording and send it to you.
No, I want to remember Pammy as Pammy was then. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us, Miss Jones. And other than that, folks, just want to say thank you very much again for listening. Back with you next week. He said, he won't believe this. I said, what? He said, I came across a lady of the night last night. He didn't exactly tell us why he had come across this lady of the night, right? And he said, and I was with her at her place, and there was a picture on the wall of a nun. And I said, why do you have a picture of a nun on the wall? She said, because that's me. And he said, what do you mean? She said, yes, I used to be a nun, but I gave it up to become an escort. And she did. And it was a brilliant story, another four-page pull-out story. Norm was quite sharp and quite shrewd. And we were working.
And did he make his excuses and leave?
Well, we never quite got into that.
Yeah, I bet not. Yeah. It's very interesting to know, if we could possibly know, what he was doing in the house of the escort in the first place.
Well, research, I think you'll find.
Yeah, that's what they call it.
He had a great love of young ladies, didn't he, Jimmy Page?
And extremely young ladies,
well, yeah, as you say, yeah. And then, of course, Robert Plant, I mean, famous for his curly locks, yeah?
Percy Plant. I think he's famous for a lot more than his curly locks, shall we say.
You know.
Unless curly locks is a euphemism.
Oh, dear.
But it is a family show.
Yeah, it is a family show. I've always kind of known inside my head that I'm a genius at something, but I haven't yet discovered what it is.